This is Dr. David Black, founding director of the American Mindfulness Research Association and associate professor of preventive medicine at the University of Southern California. My guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Greeson, assistant professor of Rowan University College of Science and Mathematics, located in New Jersey. Dr. Greeson earned a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Miami and completed advanced training in health psychology at Duke University Medical Center. He is a fellow of the Institute for Integrative Health, and he is a licensed clinical psychologist with over 15 years of practice. And he also has a research program that focuses on the use of mindfulness training for stress-related disease. Welcome, Dr. Greeson.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's a thrill to join you on one of your inaugural podcasts.
Great. And so can you tell us about your clinical background and the types of patients you've worked with? You told me you have 15 years of experience. It's a lot of time to learn. And so tell us about that.
Yes. So as you had kindly mentioned in the introduction, I am a licensed clinical psychologist, and I was licensed for many years in North Carolina, where I was a faculty member at Duke for several years. In the last 7 years, I've lived in Philadelphia, so I'm now licensed in the state of Pennsylvania as well. And in terms of what drew me into wanting to do clinical work and in clinical psychology is the sort of mental health crisis. And part of that is there's sort of an epidemic of mindlessness in modern society. You know, it's hard to pay attention to things. We can get wrapped up in sort of worrying and catastrophizing about every little thing, making mountains out of molehills. And also there are very serious things to be legitimately worried about. But these things in our life, now we're going through COVID. It's lasting far longer than anyone thought. Even irrespective of COVID, there's always economic stressors, the stress of school, finding work, losing work, our health, our family, our friends, our relationships, our mental health. And so I always have felt drawn to the connection actually between mental health and physical health. I think this mind-body connection is something that I've always just really been interested in, you know, personally, and also wanting to go into a field where you could help people use their mind-body connection, mind-brain-body connection through mindfulness, for example, or therapy, to become healthier in mind and body and behavior. And so clinical psychology is a field that allows you to do that. And at the University of Miami, the reason I wanted to go there is there's actually a field within clinical psychology called health psychology. And again, as you mentioned, and that's basically the practice of clinical psychology in healthcare settings, in hospitals or academic medical centers or clinics, where you can work with physicians, nurses, other people in the medical profession, but to, again, kind of bring the mind and body back together. Mental health is part of health, and so mental health care should really be part of just healthcare. And so clinical health psychologists often practice in these sort of medical or healthcare settings. And so I had experience doing that as a graduate student at University of Miami, and then working at Duke Integrative Medicine in North Carolina. We sort of took a whole person approach where their mental health was central. And then I've continued to do that in my work in Philadelphia since then. And I'm sure we can talk about the role of mindfulness, how it interweaves with all of those things.
And so the types of patients you've worked with, in noting that you mentioned that we mindlessness and stress and the spectrum of those things, I'm assuming you've worked with severe cases and not so severe, maybe just day-to-day issues that people were trying to overcome challenges and cope better with. So who have you worked with in this way?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, I think, to some degree, who we work with somewhat depends on where we are. So for example, as a graduate student, in Miami, Florida, the type of diversity it had was it was a very, Spanish speaking area of the country. A lot of people from Cuba and, Latin America, South America. So you heard a lot of Spanish. And although I don't speak Spanish, it did sort of infuse the culture. And so explaining things like mental health or anxiety or whatever, some people, to them, anxiety is, I have a stomach ache. to other people, I have anxieties. I can't stop thinking of this thing I'm worried about in my life. So you kind of have to, we say, keep the person at the center of person-centered care, because people, depending on their culture, their background, where you're practicing in the country, they might say the same word, but it might mean different things, like anxiety, for example. So one of the awakenings of doing graduate training in Miami was sort of language and culture. And just because we're reading books on cognitive behavioral therapy or mindfulness or psychodynamic therapy in graduate school certainly does not mean everyone we're in the room one-on-one with knows all of those same terms. So again, kind of relationship building, trust, rapport, communication, being person-centered, that the work is about them, you know, not about you. Those were some of the first lessons I learned in Miami. And also being able to work with kind of a diverse range of clients, not only in terms of age, but country of origin, sexual orientation, gender identity, all that, the economic range from very wealthy to lower socioeconomic status. It's a challenge, but I think that was one area of the country that we got a lot of experience as graduate students learning to become psychologists and psychotherapists in a place like that.
And what were the outcomes or the behavioral conditions or mental health conditions? Who are you working with in that context?
Yeah, I think some of the most common things were anxiety disorders, and there are different ones. So, for example, what they call a GAD or generalized anxiety disorder. It's basically there's at least five or more things in your life that it's hard to control worrying about them. And again, it could be health, it could be relationships, it could be finances, it could be school, it could be the climate, you know, but as long as there's kind of, it's several things, but the distinction is that it's hard to sort of stop yourself from worrying about all those things. That's why they say it's sort of generalized. And also when you try to stop it, it almost backfires. It kind of pulls you in even more. So there's a lot of kind of generalized anxiety. I remember seeing quite a few people, a lot of times anxiety and depression often go together. And whereas anxiety are kind of, you're worried about things that might happen in the future, but they also might not. But it's based on you're worrying. They may or may not happen. You don't know, but you're worried that they might. Depression tends to be more focused on the past. You know, we're kind of ruminating on sad things that have happened before. And those things, they've already happened. You know, we can't go back and change it. But what's interesting about anxiety and depression in terms of where we're focused on in terms of time in our life, anxiety, we're worrying about things that haven't even happened yet. Depression and kind of sadness, we're kind of getting stuck in the past, which has already happened. And what that means is with either one of those, where aren't we in the here and now? You know, and so that's sort of one of the things that mindfulness, for example, which is helping us be present, live more in the here and now, what is actually happening now versus what might or might not happen or what's happened in the past. And there's a lot of mental health implications of that. So we kind of talk to people that were dealing with anxiety or depression. Substance use is common in there too. Sometimes there's personality characteristics or personality disorder, the narcissism or avoidant personality or borderline, things like that. And they tie into your mental health as well. So those are some of the most common things. There's also adjustment disorder, where if you have a loss or a new medical condition that's really cancer or chronic pain or something, you're having trouble adjusting to it. That was pretty common too. They call adjustment disorder. It might not be a full-fledged anxiety disorder or major depression. It's called adjustment disorder. You're having trouble adjusting to something stressful happening in your life. And there's different types of therapies you can do to that. Now mindfulness is kind of becoming infused in a lot of these types of therapies. So there's more and more evidence for this, but the key is kind of a communicating that and offering that to people. And I always say, whatever we do, we want to do it so that it's voluntary, not mandatory. You know, we're not here to cram any particular therapy down people's throat. You know, we want them to do it because they're interested, they're curious, they're receptive without us kind of pushing the agenda on them.
Very good. So it seems like you've seen and worked with various conditions, anxiety, depression, substance use disorders, other personality disorders. And I'm wondering, is there a theme? You're mentioning mindfulness approaches as a theme. Is it workable across these multiple conditions? And if it is, why?
Yes, this is something that's a really important, timely, salient issue in the field of psychology, psychotherapy, and mental health right now. In fact, this even ties into a little bit of the research funding that the National Institute of Health, NIH, which everyone knows through Dr. Fauci and the COVID vaccines, but there's a NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health. There's complementary and integrative health. So the NIH, the National Institute of Mental Health, is trying to think in a new way about how we categorize, think about, approach mental illness, mental disorders. And right now there's a big thick book I have over there on my shelf. It's about 3 or 4 inches thick, a couple thousand pages, that has all the different diagnoses and all the criteria. And it takes years to get to know all these disorders. And there's a million different variants, and all of which can need a different type of therapy. The new sort of approach that I think you're getting at with this question is, are there any common threads that cut across different types of mental health conditions or mental illness? And I'll give you a couple of examples. One would be having trouble with emotions. That sounds very broad. Trouble regulating our emotions, trouble controlling our emotions, trouble expressing our emotions, things like that. So that's called trouble with emotion regulation, or regulating our emotions. Now, if you think about anxiety, depression, substance use, eating disorders, sleep disorders, adjustment disorder, personality, emotional kind of ups and downs, trouble recognizing, regulating, and expressing your emotion kind of cuts across a lot of these different conditions in that big, thick diagnostic manual of mental disorders. So you could look at them all as being separate, or you could think, now hang on a second, emotion regulation, or being able to regulate our emotions skillfully, that is involved in or implicated in a whole host of diagnoses. So it's transdiagnostic. Emotional regulation cuts across a variety of disorders. So nowadays, getting better at recognizing, expressing, communicating, and controlling emotion, that has been shown to help with, newsflash, anxiety, depression, PTSD, eating disorders, sleep disorders, chronic pain, and personality disorders. And mindfulness is one way of several that can kind of help us get, when we're more mindful, we're aware of emotion. What is it? Can I sense it? Where do I sense it? In my body, my mind? How does it affect my behavior, maybe my reactions? Can I sit and watch that without reacting? So there's these kind of mindful qualities that we call transtherapeutic. You know, they might be a reason that explains why some of these things like mindfulness can be so helpful across a range of conditions, because mindfulness and other types of therapy are kind of addressing these root problems like emotion regulation, or another one is kind of being very self-focused. You know, if we're really focused on ourselves, we're really not keeping other people in mind. Again, if you think about the self-focused nature of anxiety, we're worrying about I, me, and my. You know, depression also tends to be very self-focused. Substance use tends to be very self-focused. Eating disorder and body image, very self-focused, etc. Being mindful is not just being aware of my own mind and body. It's being aware of other people out there, too, and relationships. And there's different levels. So, yes, kind of lots of disorders can be unified by a few things like regulating emotion, or how focused are we on ourselves or others. And there's different vehicles to do that. And mindfulness is one of those.
And so mindfulness as a vehicle, what is the definition that you might use with a client? So if you were approaching them to, like you said, give an option, you don't force it on anyone, but to suggest mindfulness to them, and if they didn't know anything about it, what might you say in clinical practice as an introduction? Some people might have an interest in doing this in their clinical practice, and they may be concerned that it may disrupt some of the rapport if the person may not be interested in this type of practice. And of course, coming from a stance of just this as being an opportunity could probably be fine. But if someone were to introduce, in your experience, how would you go about doing it and defining the term mindfulness?
Yeah, it's it can be a little tricky to come up with a pithy sort of simple definition. There are lots of somewhat complex definitions out there, and they're interesting. But I think if you boil it down, there's kind of two essential ingredients. You know, if we're being mindful, we're being aware. That's one of them. And if we're being mindful, we're trying to sort of accept whatever we do become aware of. Now, that's the harder part. It's sometimes not that hard to become aware of things. And in fact, sometimes the more aware you become of some things, particularly if they're distressing or upsetting things like your mood or you're not in a good place in life right now, and you're bringing more attention to that, you're becoming more aware of that, it can actually make you more upset because you're giving it your full attention and awareness. That's where the kind of mindful acceptance quality comes in. So I sort of say being mindful is about kind of non-judgmental awareness. It's not just paying attention and being aware of things. That is true, but that's only part of it. The second part is endeavoring to, in the given moment that we're aware of something, our kids, ourselves, our day, a moment of the day, a time in life, something that goes wrong or right, that we're aware of that, but we're also kind of accepting whatever that is. And not sort of acceptance as a doormat, this non-judgmental awareness. Acceptance, I kind of talk about the four A's of mindfulness: attention, awareness, acceptance, and action. And so we're not just accepting things to be a doormat and life is just going to, you know, like run all over us, because becoming accepting of what you're aware of that you've paid attention to, you then can act on that. And that's where the skillfulness comes in. How do we want to act? How do we want to empower ourselves to act? What are our options? What are our choices? Can I decide what I want to do consciously instead of just automatically kind of all these impulses and reactions are just driving what I do every day? Often, sometimes that's fine, but often being kind of more reactive and not so conscious or kind of more mindless, that can lead to some problems, overeating, you know, substance use. We're more kind of not paying attention to other people when we're like that, paying attention, becoming more aware, doing our best to accept whatever we do become aware of, but then also it's kind of taking some wise action on that. That's where I think the wisdom and the kind of self-empowerment and the health potential of being mindful comes in. So I try and call it non-judgmental awareness and walk people through the four A's like that.
And do you ever use the term meditation, and do you use it selectively based on the rapport you have with your client? And do you make the connection to what you're asking them to do in the definition of mindfulness through the practice of meditation?
Great point. Yes. So I sort of frame it for people that we all have the natural ability to be mindful. You know, those four A's, we can all pay attention to things. We're already doing that. We can all become aware of things, more aware. We can all do better accepting things we become aware of, and we can all take action on that. So we can all be mindful. Some people are really good at it. Some aren't. Most of us are somewhere in the middle, the old bell curve. And we all already have some degree of mindfulness, whether we've done meditation or not done meditation or yoga or whatever. We just all already have some ability to be mindful just naturally. Everybody has some. Now, like practice, you played football, I played basketball, other people play an instrument, other people, whatever. We get good at what we practice. So how do we want to become more mindful? Well, it takes some practice. Meditation, we were talking about vehicles. Meditation, it can come in different forms, very simple, more elaborate ones. But meditation is kind of the vehicle through which we become more mindful. So what do we do when we meditate? If we're meditating on the breath, we're paying attention to the breath. We're becoming more aware of the kind of breath filling the body, filling it, leaving it cool, warm, all those sort of senses of the fluctuations of the breath. We're becoming more aware of trains of thought, you know, going through the mind. Now, the tricky thing is we're practicing meditation. We're paying attention to these things. We're becoming more aware of the body and the mind and so forth, even some impulses or reactions. Now, what's harder is to accept the fact that all that stuff is going on. But if we are able to get better at that, then we're in control of our action, not all these automatic impulses and habits, you know, being in control of our actions. So I think that's kind of where practicing meditation comes in, whether it's mindful breathing or lying down or taking a slow walk through nature or doing this with a retreat with other people or a class with other people, but doing some sort of meditation practice. Some people do it through kind of prayer. They can really center themselves and do those same things. It's a growth, kind of a developmental process. So that takes us from wherever we start with our natural level of being mindful or whatever, and sort of moves the needle on it, as a function of practicing meditation in some form or fashion. Again, if people are open to it and interested in it.
Were there any circumstances where you realized it probably wasn't the way to go with a person who, with whatever disorder that or ailment that was bothering them, and you recognized it's either the case of this person that it's not helpful for, or more generally, perhaps this behavioral disorder or other disorder, it wasn't as effective as you would have anticipated?
Yeah, there are a couple of just people I worked with over the years that come to mind right away when you mentioned that. So one gentleman I remember from North Carolina was really struggling with panic attacks. He came to see us at Duke Integrative Medicine. I think he was getting the medical perspective on it, seeing an acupuncturist to kind of just work with the sympathetic nervous system and try and calm that down. But he was also aware there's a psychological component to it, so seeing a psychologist or a health psychologist, because he had a lot of the physical symptoms of anxiety and panic too. You know, his heart was racing, he was sweating a lot, muscles were really tense. Again, the body's, wherever the mind goes, the body follows. So if the mind's getting really anxious and panicky, the body is going to tense up and kind of react to that as well. So sometimes people end up seeing different professionals, not only a psychologist, because it depends on what their symptoms are. But I remember the first time I saw him, and I think he had heard of mindfulness, and maybe it was a flyer or the physician recommended it or something, but he didn't, he was anxious. So he didn't want to do a class where you're in there with 20 other people and no one knows each other at first, and you kind of have to get to know one another. But people that are sometimes more anxious or more socially anxious, they'd feel more comfortable working with somebody one-on-one. So that was a good decision. So we're in there in the room, and he's kind of anxious, and he's pretty aware of this already. So I said, okay, let's start with a 5 or 10 minute mindful breathing. So we start doing it, and he's getting more fidgety. I try and often guide with my eyes closed. People can keep them open or closed, whatever they're most comfortable with, but I kind of open mine, and then I see his eyes are wide open. They're getting wider. He's getting more fidgety, and he kind of like, how are you feeling? I'm feeling worse. And then he was like, I got to stop. And he actually got up and just sort of got up from the chair and just walked out the door. And I think went to the front desk and even left. And I felt so guilty because I was much earlier on in my, you know, clinical work and my clinical practice. And what I thought is, I've been practicing meditation. I've done mindful breathing. If you've done it once, you've done it a million times. It helps people calm down. It helps you not become so attached to those thoughts. And if you're not so attached, you can kind of let them be in your body. Your brain can kind of release from that. Your body can calm down. But I was making an assumption that just because I had done it a lot, or people in the classes I had been in were comfortable, it's not comfortable for everyone, especially not the first time. So sometimes kind of going straight at the symptom that's the most bothersome without kind of first building some trust and sort of maybe there would have been another thing that probably didn't focus on the breath, because that was kind of the center of a lot of what made him anxious. I can't breathe. And I think he might've had asthma or something too. And so it kind of backfired. And in hindsight, my intention was, let's do something in the beginning to kind of, become more focused on the present and stop, you know, worrying into the future so much. Let's kind of become here and now, and then we'll proceed with the session. But I should have probably not done the mindful breathing. Sometimes you never know until you try. And we probably should have just established a little bit more rapport, trust. Have you tried these things before? What worked? What hasn't? What's he most interested in? And kind of let him guide me, instead of I thought I had the best thing at that moment. And just for that person that time, it kind of backfired. That's one time. A lot of other times it worked great. But it's not necessarily sort of an automatic to just do mindfulness with everybody we see.
Yeah, that's a good point. It makes me think of a couple things. One being, for some individuals, is there a sequence to find a baseline whereby mindfulness has its most utility? So does a person need to have a certain level of relaxation just to begin it? And I know some individuals and teachers will use a physical feature of meditation like yoga to get a person just calm enough that they can attend to the breath, as you mentioned with this case, without running out the door because they're feeling severe, perhaps anxiety. Mm-hmm. So it was just a case, and you know, it happens from what it sounds like, not often, but for those, and maybe it's a circumstance where anything you ask this individual to do on that day could have sent them out the door. But I'm wondering, is there a type of baseline that you see necessary either by person's disposition or by clinical progress to where you can say, it seems like mindfulness in this moment is what is useful for the therapeutic process?
Yeah, I'm just sort of reflecting on that to think if they're sort of in the room with someone accused like that, because he was probably of all the people I've seen the most, even when he came in before we started that practice, very kind of talking rapidly. You could tell just by his posture, already pretty tense. And sort of like you said, we could have maybe done progressive muscle relaxation or anything else. And I don't know if the same thing would have happened. I picked mindfulness, you know, so I really don't know. So sometimes it is hard to tell until you try. I think a general rule of thumb, especially, you know, anybody in the health profession or mental health profession, I think one of the principles is knowing what people have tried before to help you get a sense of what have they tried before, what's been helpful, what hasn't, in terms of probably starting with something that's been helpful before and they've just gotten out of the habit of it or whatever, but to do something familiar, something comfortable, something that they've had success in, that they know what it is. It's not an unknown, it's a known quantity. Those are the kind of things that you can feel out first to probably jump into as a first attempt versus trying something brand new. This is a general principle. I feel like there's a second part to the question. So kind of reading.
The second part, maybe you had something else, but mine was not that case per se, but more generally, is there a useful sequence? You mentioned several psychotherapies that you've been trained on and that clinical psychologists apply. Is there any sequence that you've seen from personal practice that appears is a moment when someone's transitioning towards mindfulness, or do you begin with mindfulness, say even in a session or part of a continuation of care? Is there any lesson to be learned there outside of the research world? Because I know some of this has been tested and people are interested in other questions related, like the number of sessions to find a benefit. But I think my question is there any therapeutic baseline perhaps that is needed before trying these practices, or there are just moments that arise when there's a recognition that inserting a mindful awareness practice or an acceptance practice, no matter what you've been delivering, is like it's a hybrid model of treatment.
Right. Again, great question. And this is sort of where the clinician and us, either as a grad student or a practicing clinician, needs to be pretty savvy about this. So there's a couple things I think of with this. One is this concept of kind of a matching or meeting someone where they are, and I'll explain that in a second. And then the other part is kind of sequencing, which you're getting at too. Let me take the second one first, the sequencing. There's some kind of ancient wisdom to this. So let's take yoga and meditation as an example. We all know if we've done yoga and meditation that if you go to a yoga class, when does the meditation occur during the yoga class? It's usually at the end, right? So sometimes it's just a minute or two, other times it's longer. But that's a deliberate sequence. You're working with the body first, and whether you're there for stress, physical tension, or chronic pain, you're just interested in mind-body practice, whatever, that for fitness, because some yoga is more rigorous, others more gentle. But you kind of start with the body and kind of end with the mind. And that's a very deliberate sequence. And I think similarly, there's a parallel there, like in psychotherapy. The two often first steps in psychotherapy, including mindfulness-based therapy, is number one, kind of information and education, explaining to people, understanding why they're there, kind of what you have to offer, what you're trained in, what you have to offer, kind of a little bit of the rationale about what it, explaining what it is, the logic behind why it's expected to work. If you've seen other people, I've seen people with things that are similar situations as you, this stuff has been pretty helpful. And you kind of explain the what and the why. So you're giving them some information and some education that can help Information education alone can help alleviate some of the anticipatory anxiety, some of the uncertainty, the fear of the unknown, and it can kind of clarify and settle some of that. So now that's a little bit more settled, or like you said, they're kind of more at a more stable baseline. Then they're more ready to do whatever you do next. And if you kind of explain that there's a sequence, I'm going to explain some of this, present the rationale, and then say with cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. The cognitive is about our thoughts, how we think, what we think, kind of personality characteristics. Thoughts often affect our behavior. So how we're thinking about things, that shapes our perception, that often affects what we do and how we act. So that's how the cognitive goes with the behavioral. And there's homework to do. You can keep a kind of record of your thoughts. You can start to see the patterns. You can sort of catch what we sort of call distorted thoughts. You know, am I overgeneralizing? Am I taking things too personally? Things like that. But as you're kind of keeping a little log of your thought, you can catch things like that. But you don't just have people start doing these thought records or kind of reframing their thoughts before you've explained, look, this is kind of, if we're thinking a lot of negative things and they're really recurring to us, we're kind of perseverating on this stuff. That's the nature of kind of how worry becomes persistent or chronic worry, or how sadness kind of starts to spiral down into more of a depression, a more persistent kind of chronic depression. And our train of thought has a lot to do with that. So that's why we're going to look for these thoughts. We're going to keep a record or a log of these thoughts. And we can, once we catch them, then we're more aware. Then we can start to reframe them or reshape them a little bit. You change your thoughts, it's going to kind of change how you're feeling and what you're doing. So getting people to a baseline where they feel like they understand what you're going to do, why you're going to do it, if there is a sequence, why the sequence is in that order, they're starting to feel more comfortable, a little more at ease, a little more relaxed, you're building some rapport, and then I think whatever the sequence is going to work better. Then the second piece I mentioned, the matching. There's sort of two approaches to matching. I mentioned the yoga and the meditation sequence. You can also think of the nature of someone's problem. As a psychologist, so I mostly deal with mental health, anxiety, depression, all that stuff. But even those things can have physical symptoms. You know, I was mentioning the person, their anxiety might be, I have a tummy ache or whatever, versus other people's like, I just can't stop worrying about, you know, am I going to get this new job, or am I going to get into grad school, or am I going to loot whatever. So that's more cognitive. The other one's more physical. So some type of matching is, if they're really in physical distress or physical discomfort, you want to add some comfort as the first step. That's the best match, you know, so to kind of do progressive muscle relaxation, release the muscle tension, that could help with kind of headaches, you know, neck and back tension and things like that. You probably wouldn't go straight into looking for thoughts if the nature of the symptoms is they're more physical symptoms. If the root of the problem is more the worrisome thoughts and the kind of catastrophizing and all that, then the better match is probably if thoughts are the root of the problem, you do want to tackle that first. So there's a matching kind of process that happens. A similar matching is with people. I mentioned the time span, the present versus the past and the future. If people are really caught up in the future or really caught up in the past, sometimes the match is what you say. You want to complement that if they're wrapped up in a different point in time, you want to complement that by bringing them back to the present, because that's where they're not going to be as distressed. It's not the future, it's not the past, it's the present. That's where the mindfulness sort of approach can be helpful. So as a clinician or a student, you're trying to kind of assess or read what's their problem? How does their problem work in terms of its time frame, the nature of the symptoms? Are they more physical? Are they more kind of thoughts or cognitive? And kind of try and educate and inform them, map out a sequence that makes some sense and that they kind of buy into, and then match whatever you do with kind of the kind of underlying root of what's causing the problem. And then see how that you mentioned responsiveness and see how they respond to that. If they respond well, you're on the right track. If it kind of blows up on you or it's kind of meh, you know, it didn't really do much, then there's other strategies to take.
And it seems like there could potentially be a point of reintroduction. I'm making an assumption here, but you can let me know that the path of making therapeutic progress, sometimes there's a moment where a person didn't realize something is useful to them, but then a tool later on becomes useful. This might be the example of the individual having overwhelming anxiety. And in the point that you made about attending to the sensations in the body, may have advanced that person to a level where they no longer feel comfortable, right, to sit there. But mm-hmm. perhaps under, you know, under a series of progressions made in therapy using other tools, is it valid to say that a reintroduction is fine at some later point, as long as you give the introduction, as you mentioned, and the purpose?
Yes, I absolutely think so. And I think another theme with mental health and sort of personal development and growth is there often is growth. I kind of often tell people, you know, what are we going to do? Stay the same our whole life? You know, or are we going to change? I mean, odds are we're probably going to change. We've already changed. We're going to continue to change in all likelihood, including in the context of mental health or mental illness. I mean, things are constantly changing. And if we work on those things, it's probably like the likelihood of change is even greater as if we didn't work on things at all. So sort of setting the table by acknowledging that things are sort of they're always changing, you know, whether we do anything about it or not. And just because we try something once, it's not a guarantee that it works, but whether it works or doesn't mean that same thing will happen the next time or the time after that or the time after that. So I think these qualities are kind of setting expectation that things aren't kind of unitary. They're always the same, you know, forever. Things are changing. Trying things at different times may result in a different experience. And I think that's one of the mindful qualities of kind of, they say, beginner's mind is it's easy to, once we've done this for a while, why would I want to, you know, do mindful breathing again? You know, we've done this a million times. Well, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the experts, there are a few, right? I think they say, Zen mind, beginner's mind. So that's important, you know, in a therapeutic context and in counseling or therapy or a mindfulness classes. And I've gotten sucked into this. I'm sure you can probably identify with this too. All of us can. If we walk in there saying, I know mindful breathing. Oh, geez, I've done the body scan. I've done mindful eating a million. Well, we haven't done it that time. And sort of this is the intersection of, are we asking everyone else to be mindful, or are we also doing this ourselves so that we have our own experience that we can sort of, we've invested in, we've done it over time, we've been there, we've wrestled and struggled with these things, so that when we're working with someone else who's trying them for the first time or the second time or the third time, we know what it's like. It's not a linear process. It's not always going to be the same. So there's that intersection of kind of our own personal practice with mindfulness or meditation or yoga or whatever therapy, in the service of applying that toward working with others to try our best to understand what they're going through and kind of what their sequence is, and giving them kind of hope and faith that things do change over time and different times you try can produce different results.
This is reminding me of a friend and a conversation I had this past weekend about sequence and when the right time is, because this individual was battling with some pretty severe anxiety about a decade ago. And I had been telling them, you know, you might want to just look into some apps depending. I didn't know what else they were doing, but you know, from my background, I was like, you know, we have these meditation apps, maybe just something to the other, whatever treatments you're going to have. It's an add on and you can experience it and tell me if it did anything. I mean, if it doesn't, move on. So at the time they're like, totally not interested. Didn't open it. Mm-hmm. Didn't even look at the app and was like, meditation. This is a bigger problem than meditation. Whatever had happened to this person, you know, in the course of 5 years, whether it be therapies they're receiving otherwise, not meditation or personal growth or life circumstance, they came back and then I reminded them, you know, there's this thing you can try. And they started using it. My friends started using it. One of these apps, I don't need to mention the name, but you can imagine there are various apps out there that can try to get you a daily meditation practice. And this person has been using it for years now. And on our recent trip this past weekend together, keeps reminding me, like, I just want to tell you that really changed my life. I know it wasn't much, but you mentioned that app. And I think it really changed the way I was dealing with my anxiety. So I'm always, it's a reminder for me. It's people can always have moments in their life, like you said, but even in a bigger way, where on one circumstance it doesn't work, and perhaps 5 years, a decade later, it's life changing. And I do find that to be interesting. So a reintroduction, I think, from this experience and what you have said is a potential. But of course not a mindfulness is not a cure all, I believe, we have agreed on. But reintroduction may work. We've been talking a lot about clinical psychology and we haven't touched on it specifically, but I think there might be something to be said here about how to develop these competencies as a clinical psychologist, because I don't know if it's part of mainstream training now, say in graduate school or other programs. Do you know the profile of developing competencies for the delivery of this in routine practice?
Yeah, that's a great question, especially for the people out there that might be listening and maybe they're thinking about applying to graduate school or maybe they're in graduate school right now in counseling or some type of psychology program. I think there's a few different ways to pursue gaining competency in any type of therapy, but including these mindfulness-based therapies. The first one is maybe now there are some classes. I actually think Professor Clive Robbins, who's now emeritus at Duke, but he had developed an early sort of I don't know if this is the right title, but something like the science and practice of mindfulness, you know, in psychology. So I think he was one of the early people that developed the course. I would have to guess other people in clinical psychology programs now may have an elective on mindfulness and mindfulness-based interventions because this was years ago. You know, now the evidence is much greater. More people are involved in the field, more faculty members, more students are interested, and more clients are doing it on their own. And maybe some of them want to work with someone. So one of the competencies is sort of who we end up working with as an advisor, either a research advisor or one of our clinical practicum mentors, and are they trained in some of these things, whether it's cognitive behavioral therapy or mindfulness-based therapies. That's one of the ways we start to develop competency in graduate school. Often a second one is some of the societies, so like American Mindfulness Research Association that you founded, and there are these other ABCT, Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies. There's APA, American Psychological Association, and there are these annual conventions. And sometimes there are pre-conference workshops, half day, a day, on some of these evidence-based interventions. CBT, psychodynamic, now there are these mindfulness-based interventions. So the people that have sort of come up with these intervention approaches, often there's a book out, sort of a therapist guide, and then you can attend one of these trainings. Often you can do that in graduate school. You can also often do these for continuing education if you're already licensed, but conference opportunities are another one. And then outside of that, there's more kind of our own professional development. So there are these mindfulness teacher trainings for different things, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, mindfulness-based stress reduction, as John, you know, Kabat-Zinn, I'm sure, and you guys will talk about, Eric Garland's mindfulness or more, mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement, and others. So we can do these too outside of a conference, but there are these sort of teacher trainings. And one that's not a specific intervention training that's just more general is my colleagues at Duke, Jeff Brantley and others developed this mindfulness for professional practice. And it's, I think, two sequences of 4 days, you know, spread out by a couple months. So you're not there to only learn MBSR or MBCT or MB, fill in the blank, whatever else. It's more whether you're an educator, law enforcement, an administrator, whatever, a therapist, a physician. You want to learn about the kind of principles and practices of mindfulness, practicing them yourself with a cohort of people that have similar kind of professional aspirations, even if their discipline is different, but you're getting sort of supervision and professional training that way. So there are kind of different levels to it that occur throughout our professional development.
And what do you think, this is a challenging question here, and it's probably unresolved in the field. Those very competencies that you are talking about and the locations by which you can get training. What about more generally what the clinical psychologist has to bring to the room in regards to their own personal practice to get it right, both in the buy-in, the instructions that have to do with mindfulness practice itself, and then navigating any problems that might arise or key moments of therapeutic change that could arise? Is it built into the graduate training to become a clinical psychologist, or are these unique skills that we need to develop as competencies that would be specific to the mindfulness domain?
Yeah, so that is a tough question. It's a great question. It's an important question. A few things I'll try and integrate into the answer here. So I think in graduate school for clinical psychology, and also in medicine and probably nursing too, you know, we learn clinical interviewing. They call it in medicine and nursing clinical interviewing, sort of clinical and communication skills in psychology. They're largely overlapping. Now, we're talking about kind of the natural ability to be mindful, and all of us kind of have that, but some have that a lot, others just have a little bit, and again, most are in the middle. So I feel like there's different parts to this. One is, if we're drawn to the field of mental health or healthcare or medicine, probably we're pretty good at it. We're comfortable being with people. We're probably good communicators. We're probably relatively mindful in terms of being self-aware, and not that we don't get anxious or get depressed or those things happen, but in general, we probably have, you know, good amounts of those kind of core qualities. But particularly the core qualities of empathy, you know, communication, compassion, trust, rapport, meeting someone where they are without kind of forcing the issue, you know, all that stuff. We record ourselves and have our supervisor watch and kind of do role play with our classmates and professors, and we try and get better at this. I'm sure that does help. I also think kind of we already come in, like you said, with a baseline. Hopefully we come in with a pretty good baseline. Some people do have to remediate this, and they can kind of get held back if it's not quite up to standard, but it's pretty rare. But you can work on those things. The other thing with the mindfulness qualities in particular is, we talk about one of the best ways to learn mindfulness is to be around someone that embodies the core qualities of mindfulness. They really embody what it's like to be mindful. They make you feel like you're the only one there. You're getting their full attention. You feel seen. You feel heard. You feel like they take all the time in the world, even if they're the busiest person you know. So there's something about it's almost kind of like being able to slow down time or be so focused on the present. You're not showing any worry about my next client, or I'm late for this meeting, or whatever else I have to do today. You're able to kind of be fully with that student, patient, colleague, class, if you're teaching, your kid, if it's a moment with your kid or whatever. Again, I think we naturally have that to some degree, but I think through, like you said earlier, the meditation or some of these trainings in grad school or the other professional trainings, we can work on practicing those qualities and kind of strengthening those and moving that dial so that we kind of can increase our ability to do and be those things for the service of kind of health and healing, including in mental health and counseling.
Yeah, and I want to go into this question a little deeper just because it seems like such a significant question. So here's a scenario, an imagined scenario. Someone's been really focusing on other psychotherapies, not mindfulness training, and they recognize by reading the literature that this might be useful. And they don't really have any background, and they don't have any training. They looked online, and they see that there are some instructions. Is there an important difference? Like, do you think there's a necessity for people who are delivering therapies and decide that meditation and mindfulness might be good for their client to have experienced it themselves? Or can you purely do this on the descriptive understanding of the technique? And I think the field as a whole is challenged by this question, because I know in the delivery of mindfulness-based trainings, when we want to determine effects, we always make sure that a stellar teacher is involved. And that means a very learned teacher on the subject. They've practiced often for years. They've led their own trainings. They've been teachers of teachers. So we would call them experts. Right. So how do we differentiate that and the importance of that to clinical practice, where someone might just say, hey, this is an addendum or ancillary to what we're doing, but it might be helpful? Is something lost? Do we really need that competency and experience?
Yeah, I mean, my immediate reaction is, learning this from someone who's pretty experienced is important. And that's not to say apps can't be helpful or books. We have a lot of these books. In fact, we're using them to support our microphones right now to get the best possible sound quality. But we've read a lot of these books. I'm sure you had mentioned the apps. I'm sure we've used the apps quite a bit. We've tried things one time. We've tried things for years on end and kept working at it, and including with teachers, and maybe a consistent teacher for a while, different teachers over the years in different places. But I noticed a real, qualitative difference between opening up, app A, B, or C, or reading a few chapters in one of these mindfulness books. And those are interesting and those are helpful. And especially when we're really not familiar with any of this, those can be excellent introductions. And there is, kind of a quality spectrum with all those things. But some of it's good quality, makes sense, easy to follow. The practices are guided well. Other ones are a little more off-putting to me in terms of kind of just don't know where this is going. They're using terms I don't really understand and they're not explaining them too well. So I do feel like it's more of a gamble to, it's easier to recommend some apps and some books. I'd feel more comfortable doing that if I myself had read those books and used those apps myself, just because what I feel more uncomfortable with is kind of asking people to do something that I haven't tried. Not that any of us can do at all. For sure we can't. But in terms of working together and knowing if someone's trying something new and they might have questions or kind of difficulties might come up, or am I doing this right? Or this, should this be working by now? How long do I have to do this? That's where us having done it ourselves, I think, comes in, and that helps us meet them where they are in those types of situations. And I also like doing these sort of trainings or classes or retreats with people that have been doing meditation their whole life. And I think some of this, it can't be on an app. It can't be in a written word. Some of it is just kind of modeling, seeing what other people do, how they are, body language, just kind of not just the verbal word. I think some of this also depends what is someone trying to get out of their work in this context, counseling or therapy. If we're offering, a book on mindfulness, a general intro to mindfulness, okay, that's fine. Maybe we can talk about it in therapy, a general app to learn some mindful breathing or, to relax with 10 deep breaths. That's one thing. If we're looking more toward the kind of transformative potential of endeavoring to become more mindful as a person in life in general and all the extensions thereof, my relationships, my family, my professional roles, my brain, my behavior, my mental and physical health, that is where I get a little more nervous about relying on a book or an app to sort of achieve those things. I feel like that is often more easily accomplished with a kind of wise guide, if you will, someone who's been doing this a lot. They can guide us. They know where we're at because they've probably been there before. That's my take on it. I'm sure different people have different takes.
And so the types, I think we're kind of merging into this idea of the delivery mechanism. And my early experiences and training and working in these programs and experiences myself with practice were group-based settings. So minimum 6 people, and in retreats, maximum 150 people. And so the groupings can be large, and there's probably an effect of that on its own right. Have you experienced both sides of that in the delivery of these programs? It sounds like at Duke there was a broader group-based program, and then you had your individual sessions. And maybe that's another thing to discuss for individuals. It's what to expect in a group, and what do you see as benefits there, and what to expect on an individual basis when delivering mindfulness programs in full or just pieces of mindfulness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've both been in session with others where sort of I was the client and I was either doing therapy or mindfulness work with someone else working with me. I've also done the same thing one-on-one where I was the therapist and I was working with other people, whether with mindfulness or counseling or mindfulness in the context of counseling. I've also both been a participant in groups, like you were saying. I've also led, many mindfulness groups, many for our studies or for other things, for employees and so forth. So it's kind of, you're getting whatever they say, both sides of the table, or, you know, both perspectives of kind of on the receiving end of the learning, and then kind of the delivering end of flipping into the teacher role, both in one-on-one and also in kind of larger group or class settings, different dynamics. Sometimes in the larger classes, it's interesting because even people are very different and their sort of stories are different. But the more you listen, it's easy to tune out. They're, you know, Sally's talking about whatever. It doesn't apply to me. Well, Sally and Jimmy and Johnny and Susan, you know, if you sit and listen mindfully, you're going to be like, no, they're different people. They have a different life. But the themes are often the same. We all have things we're worried about. We all have things that stress us out. We all have things that bring us joy, things that surprise us in life. So when you kind of look, we were talking about that self versus kind of other, or kind of a commonality focus versus me individually or self-absorbed. That can play out in these mindfulness classes too. And you can tell people are reaching for their phones or whatever instead of listening to each other. So I think what can happen in the group that can't really happen one-on-one as much as a sense of, wow, you know, I'm not the only one, you know, dealing with this. Even if the example or the story is a little different, the theme is the same. You know, if you kind of do these classes over time, one-on-one, it is kind of by definition more individualized. You're only there with one other person. They're getting all the time and attention. It is all about them. That's what they're kind of paying for. That's what you're there to help with. But yeah, different dynamics, sort of, different themes emerge, a sense of commonality. But I do feel like one kind of root of mental health and mental health sort of challenges is when we, and this is leading into the potential value of classes, and whether it's an exercise class, a mindfulness class, a yoga class, a support group, some type of group-based class, not feeling alone. You're not the only one. There are other people, they have their version, but it's kind of related to what you're dealing with. I think the support and the perspective you gain through doing that is very powerful. Even if it's a little nerve-wracking to be part of a group where you don't know people at first, that's often pretty powerful in a healing experience, and quite rewarding for people that kind of can muster up the determination and the courage to try that, even if they're not as comfortable at first. Maybe they start one-on-one, but then maybe try a smaller group and maybe then a bigger group.
And I do see an intersecting point between psychotherapy and what we might call mindfulness trainings for the general population. And I'll give an example here through our programs at my university. So we have this broad program. It's all comers. It's covered by the university to maintain wellness on campus. And it's almost flipping kind of the direction of what you were talking about on its head when our teachers are trained mostly in mindfulness programs and are very good teachers in that respect, have high competencies, but they don't have the psychotherapy and clinical psychology background. And we had to make important decisions there, because if you do identify someone in need of more advanced help, having what we might call this broad wellness or public health, public mental health program was not the right fit when people were in severe need. So part of the facilitator's role, the teacher's role, was to identify people who clearly needed more, right, than our 5 or 6 week program, like in session saying, I have so much anxiety, I can't sit here, I'm losing control of my life, or one of my closest friends has recently committed suicide and I'm feeling depressed. And as those things bubble up in groups, it was important to have a competent teacher who says, oh, it's actually the other direction. It's more, you know, intensive psychotherapy, perhaps, with someone right now, given that you're reporting these symptoms that might say a general wellness program is not good enough. So that was our responsibility. And then have you seen it the other way? So that's my experience, seeing it go from, here's a broad-based program for all comers, and then we are sensitive to recognizing some individuals are much more in need than a general group-based program. Have you seen the case where, because I'm assuming it could go the other way, where you're working with a client and you might make the recommendation either at the end of their intensive individual care, you say, I'd like to recommend this group for you because what we've learned together seems like you're holding your own, but might have this aftercare benefit from being in a group who's discussing things like that.
Yeah, I completely agree. I've seen that go both ways too. And I've certainly kind of suggested, and I can think of quite a few people that have gone into mindfulness groups or yoga or whatever. Some were already doing it when I saw them. Other times it was kind of an extension of the work we had done together. And just like you said, when you've identified something, made some progress, you know, hopefully good progress. But in terms of mental health and probably medicine in general, we want to be cautious of, oh, 6 sessions or 8 sessions or 10 sessions of therapy or whatever, that it's kind of like if our insurance covers 10 sessions, then we have to be cured. So it has to be a silver bullet, 8 or 10 sessions, then come session 10, that's it. No more anxiety, no more depression. Well, that ain't life. You know, hopefully there is a lot of progress by week 8 or 10. And if that's what's covered, that's great. And a lot of the kind of research does support things that are that long, and it can be very helpful. But, you know, and individual results may vary, you know, as they say. So if there's been progress and we're talking about information, education, sequencing, matching, interest, curiosity, responsiveness, stuff like that, focusing on ourselves, focusing on others, both and getting involved in something that can be an ongoing continuation. A gets away from the silver bullet, blank number of weeks, and then, oh, now I should be more mindful or I shouldn't be depressed or anxious or anymore. That's kind of magical thinking. And if that happens, that's wonderful. But if it doesn't, it's not some failure. Some of these things we can keep on working, and other people are probably working on these same things. You know, this sort of mental health diagnoses, if 40 or 50% of the country, if you add up all of the mental health diagnoses, it's roughly half the U.S. population has a mental disorder. It begs the question, what's a disorder and what's normal if it's 50-50 in our society? And so in terms of continuity of care, ongoing work, continuing, if you've made progress to, if they want to, if they feel like it's helpful and it's worth their time, yeah, definitely. I think there can be that intersection between the individual work and ongoing programs or communities to become part of through groups. And similarly, like you had said, for kind of the mental health screening part of all of this, it's getting more recognition, and it should, and less destigmatized. Screening through employee health, or professors are always watching our students in the classroom, particularly in psychology. A lot of, not everybody's a clinician, but a lot of us are. There are these kind of mental health first aid things to really look if there's a change in behavior, or kind of people looking disheveled or not saying things for weeks on end, missing from class for weeks on end. It doesn't mean they're all committing suicide, but these are warning signs that merit, you know, follow up. So yeah, there's kind of the public health as a mental health screener, and then provide care accordingly if you can find the people, and also the one-on-one to the ongoing, maybe group-based care for continuation. Yeah, both make a lot of sense.
And the opportunities for listeners who want to know how to access these, we've mentioned intensive psychotherapy or clinical psychologists that you can work with, group-based, both on probably more intensive level group-based versus community-based programs that you can probably find locally, and then app-based. So there's a lot of coverage, but as we're making the point, probably depends on the level of the problem that you're reporting. So you've written on you mentioned earlier this transdiagnostic idea, and it seems very important. We've refined a lot of our terms. We've found categories and niches to place mental health symptoms into, and then we can bill insurance appropriately for the type of diagnosis. And this has been useful, but perhaps there are some underlying features of that mindfulness targets that would give us a rationale as to why we would apply them in so many different ways. This tool in so many ways, this approach in so many ways for so many disorders. So can you just define what transdiagnostic means in the world of clinical psychology? And would a term like this be unique or special in any way relative to how we've thought in the past?
Yeah, good question. So trans means across, so transdiagnostic across diagnoses. So transdiagnostic is referring to things. I think earlier we were talking about difficulty kind of with our emotions, or difficulty kind of regulating or controlling our emotions. So that cuts across, or it's transdiagnostic, a variety of mental health conditions, from anxiety disorders. It's difficult to kind of regulate your emotions when you're really anxious all the time. It's hard to control it, like we talked about with generalized anxiety earlier. It's hard to stop worrying about all these things. In other words, it's hard to kind of control that worry or that fearful or anxious emotion. Emotions involved in depression, sadness, rumination, so forth. It's easy to get sucked into the downward spiral. It can be hard to control that. So emotion regulation is involved in that. Sleep, if people are really kind of physically tense or wrapped up in their kind of their thoughts, their worrying, it can be hard to sleep. That's trouble regulating emotion too, and so on. But emotion and thought kind of also go hand in hand. So emotion regulation is one, quote, transdiagnostic thing that cuts across a variety of mental health conditions. What we call perseverative cognition, or another, perseverating, we're thinking of the same thing over and over and over again. Often we're thinking about negative things over and over and over again. So we kind of say, when people are perseverating like that, or catastrophizing, or kind of ruminating or worrying, those are the thoughts that drive those negative feelings of fear or sadness or low self-esteem or whatnot. But it's repetitive negative thinking. It's kind of like that engine. It's like, that also is, PTSD, eating disorder, so on, and personality. And there's others, but they cut across a lot of mental health conditions. And kind of the new way of thinking about it is, you could just do cognitive therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy for 10 weeks or 16 or whatever. And there's a variety of things in CBT. It's not just one thing, but it kind of centers around, if thinking is the problem, then can we think about things differently? Can we reframe our way of thinking about it? And if we can, we might be less susceptible to feeling afraid or feeling depressed or whatever. So reshaping how we think about things is very helpful. That's the cognitive therapy. So that can be helpful. With the mindfulness, it's sort of like, okay, if we're getting caught up in this repetitive negative thinking, we're having trouble controlling our emotions, we're also kind of not in the present too much, we're kind of worrying in the future, ruminating or regretting the past, doing things that bring us more into the present. Also, that book you had mentioned, Coming to Our Senses, is kind of the double meaning. It's actually literally coming to our physical senses. What do we see? What can we touch? What do we hear? Our felt sense of things, our body or our environment. Well, it turns out, and there's a whole neuroscience around this, and other people are much more expert in it than I am, but I think the reason why kind of trouble with emotions and trouble with thinking cut across different disorders, one of the ways mindfulness can be helpful is we're coming to our senses. Are we eating something? Are we coming to our senses of sight and smell and touch and the body? Those areas of the brain, those somatosensory areas, are totally different regions than what gets caught up with anxiety or emotional reactions or kind of that self-focused. Those are different areas than we're out in the more somatosensory areas that are engaged through these meditation practices that are very sensory, really, breathing, the body, eating, walking, and so forth, the yoga postures. So there's kind of a whole neuroscience of this, of why there's a new approach toward realizing the root of these problems and how they cut across different disorders. And now we can pick something, whether it's mindfulness or some other kind of transdiagnostic treatment. How does it work? Why might it not have to be as complicated as we formerly thought? I think that's where things are going right now, and why some of these things like mindfulness, paying attention to the present moment, coming to our senses, if you will, focusing not only on negative emotions and kind of like the program mindfulness-based stress reduction. It's not just about reducing stress and the negative emotions, like Barb Fredrickson and others. It's about broadening and building positive emotions. Other people are talking about this now. So kind of emotional balance, which isn't just decreasing the negatives, but it's also being on the lookout for and more fully experiencing and really absorbing as best you can positive emotions, that contributes to emotional balance, which is kind of the opposite of mental disorder. So we could go on and on, but those are some of the key, I think, pieces to transdiagnostic and how mindfulness and other therapies might fit in the current thinking.
So, and the mention is really about the regulatory elements. Is it, so you mentioned emotion regulation. The perseverative cognition, is this also a form of self-regulation, or do you think it is more what we might call bottom-up? The person is living more often in the sensory world, and so there's a natural dampening of cognition, or both? Self-regulate, so top-down self-regulation, or people are breathing for periods of time without judging, and so naturally over time, there's less to judge.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I was kind of mentioning earlier the idea of we were talking about sequencing and also matching. And part of matching is if you have a physical symptom, it can use a physical solution. If you have a cognitive symptom, it could use a cognitive solution. But sometimes we talk about this principle of complementarity or complementing the person's symptom. An example of how mindfulness fits in there, kind of linked to this neuroscience and what you're saying about bottom up, meaning kind of taking a sensory approach to a quote cognitive or psychological problem. So say somebody has anxiety, depression, trauma, or PTSD, personality, whatever it might be. It's a psychological issue, meaning it's heady. It's kind of a thinking based, you know. Well, a complement to that is to kind of get out of the mind and get into the body. And that's where the yoga, the body scan, breathing, sensory things like in nature or whatever, even inside the house, stepping out of the kind of default mode of the story of I, me, and mine and kind of all that gets wrapped up. And we've kind of lost awareness of this body and all these senses that we can come to. We can come to them through eating or noticing different scents or seeing different things or putting our body in motion, whether it's through yoga or walking or just lying down out in a park. But when we do that and we're kind of coming to our senses, if you will, it's also like, you know, like, let's come to our senses here, because there is a wisdom and an insight to all of that, including a neuroscientific insight of if the root of the problem kind of at the brain level is this default mode and all these kind of things become very narrow, can we step out of that, widen the lens, have a more whole person experience, including coming to all of our senses. And that is a complement to the very kind of cognitive, heady, thinking-based root of a lot of these mental health problems. I don't know if that explanation makes sense, but
it does. And an example coming to my mind when you're mentioning people getting heady, it was almost there's a part of that that is the addiction to being in the mind. So I've known and worked with people who apparently when you give them other options of getting into the body, it seems so uninteresting, because chasing the thought train, there was something so compelling about that. There was something to be resolved that was never resolved. There was something that was so attention grabbing that it seemed like they could think about it until the end of time. And to try these practices, they were, there are at least some cases where they're so disinterested because that information in the head, even though it's unresolvable in most circumstances, just captured attention. And it seems like this would align with a non-pharmacological form of addiction, like a behavioral form of addiction, or a cognitive form of addiction where the thoughts themselves cannot be let go of. And have you seen this? And what do you have something to say about an individual who may not even be aware that this is, I'm not going to use the term addiction properly, but perhaps it has addictive potential, right, where thoughts themselves are the hyper focus and everything else becomes disinterested?
Yeah. There's a group of us at Rowan, including at the medical school, that kind of cuts across psychiatry, neurology, psychology. We're thinking about sort of, mindfulness and technology addiction right now. But like you said, addiction, it's a formal word. We don't want to overgeneralize that to kind of all this stuff. But, these kind of principles or qualities of, how do we get addicted to the binge watching Netflix, or we're on our phone, we can, you know, run these things of how many apps have I been on all day? I tell my wife, oh, I've probably been, you know, 10 minutes on Instagram. Maybe I check Facebook once or twice. Well, then you pull it up and it's like, no, how about 3 hours on Instagram and an hour on Facebook and 5 hours on email or whatever. So, but I think one of the qualities of quote unquote addiction is we kind of lose track of time. We get so immersed following or pursuing something or needing something, and whether it's information, trains of thought, just stuff we're curious about, interested in, tracking down, whether it's thoughts, substances, technology, social media, reading, whatever form it takes. But it can be quote unquote addicting. And if something's addicting, it's got to be rewarding, right? Or else we wouldn't do it. You know, it's got to be so interesting or so thought provoking, or we're learning more if I can only put a little more time into this, or I've seen these episodes, let me get a couple more, few more in before I go to sleep, or, ooh, this is good, but if some is good, is more better, let me try. Yeah, it is, and even more. It's got those types of qualities. Now, reward leads to reinforcement, leads to habit, which can potentially lead to outright addiction, at least we think of that with substances or prescription meds or whatever. Can happen with other behaviors too. So then I've heard Jeb Brewer, for example, talk about this and other people kind of applying these principles of behavior, addiction, reward, reinforcement, habit formation. How do we break habits? To just noticing kind of how we're spending our time, and do we really want to be doing that? Or are we getting conditioned through all these things, whether it's social media or our own mind or whatever, luring us in and it's hard to get out? Can we notice that? Can we catch that? Can we offer ourselves some alternatives that are equally rewarding, maybe in different ways? But when people are stuck on things like this, sometimes I like to think about it. Oh, you're the kind of person that you really are able to get interested in a lot of things, huh? Oh yeah, I have a lot of it. So you're establishing you're the kind of person that's picks up new interests or can follow a new interest. What? There's maybe some other things that sound pretty interesting. Oh, really? Let's try that. And you're kind of like starting off with what they're, quote, good at, even if being good at it leads to taking up a lot of time or causing some distress. But what you're kind of – how you're framing that is you have some skills and some abilities that if you channel them or redirect them, you can use those same skills and abilities to kind of go a different direction, a less distressing direction. And when they discover that, it becomes rewarding. You want to do that more. And that is this kind of behavior change, or kind of using reinforcement and reward to our in our favor.
Yeah, if we could unlock that and – help people habituate to healthier behaviors. That would be fantastic. Any final thoughts on next stage advances in the use of mindfulness in clinical psychology?
Yeah, one thing you kind of prime me with and foreshadowing some of these questions, and this is one I don't have the answer to, but I think it's an important issue, an important question, is and this goes for any therapy, really, but including the mindfulness-based therapies now. I sort of think of with these issues of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. You said, what is mindfulness? Well, I gave it a non-judgmental awareness, but mindfulness can mean different people, different things to different people. Who's defining mindfulness? Can it be redefined? Can it be framed for different people, different community? We're talking about culture and background with Miami and so forth. That applies anywhere. So I kind of think of with new therapies that are coming out, particularly in psychology and counseling, and you can include the mindfulness world of mindfulness-based therapies, who is the developer of these new therapies or interventions? So who's developing them? Who are they for? Who are they tested on? So as we get evidence-based practice and, you know, research and evidence-based practice in medicine and psychology, who's the evidence based on? Who does that evidence apply to or not? Who was involved in the research? Whose voice, you know, who's the, all that stuff. So I think kind of accessibility, inclusion, voice, ownership, definition, redefinition, all that stuff, is important. I think it's getting better. It's got a long ways to go. We're at least, I think, cognizant of it. Again, one thing through your organization and the Mindfulness Journal and all these other things, I think a lot more people are in this area now. Hopefully it's more and more kind of welcoming and visible and impactful. But I do think that is one present, but also area for the future is kind of who's involved in mindfulness, who's doing the research, who's the research on, who does it apply to, who doesn't it, who's defining this or redefining this, and all that stuff I think is very, very important going forward.
Thank you. So let's conclude our discussion for today. So we've covered, we've had a great discussion on understanding mindfulness in the context of clinical psychology. So I hope this is useful to individuals, graduate students, and those just interested broadly in the field, including clinical psychologists themselves. I want to thank you, Dr. Grayson, for joining me today. And our listeners can find our recordings and the full menu of services at goamra.org. That's goamra.org. And you can support us there by becoming a member or subscriber. That's it for today. Bye now.